as the opposite of care. So inattention and neglect as kind of the counter images. Yeah, sure. I mean, inattention, certainly. Neglect, again, I'd not thought of that, but if we neglect someone particularly, it's difficult to see how we're caring for them. Neglect is a form of uncaring, really. But again, it goes back to the gentleman's question this morning. I think with these kind of core ideas, what happens is that as we reflect on them, as we try to sort of dig down into what they mean for us, they bring up, in your case, a range of associations, in this gentleman's case, likewise. And I think that's an integral part of how this practice or this process works. But yeah, sure. Mm. Yes. What is the case? Yeah.
And therefore, the distinction is not as clear cut as I thought it was at the beginning.
Well, what I was quite deliberately and perhaps slightly provocatively trying to sort of turn things on their head. It's also true that people who present Buddhism, let's say, as a way of understanding the way things are, do that in order to create a foundation for how to live. I mean, they're clearly not two separate things. But my feeling is that the know that, knowing how things are, has become somehow privileged and has become dominant, particularly around the narratives of enlightenment. And that's what concerns me, because that's a very, very core, central value. And if that is presented to us in terms of knowing reality as it is, that somehow weights the whole discourse in favor of knowing that rather than knowing how. Knowing how is a sort of secondary consequence of. I would argue it's the other way round. Of course, it's important to gain clear knowledge and information and understanding in order to live in a caring way. I mean, if we're caring for an elderly parent, for example, you know, you need to understand their situation. You need to know maybe what is medically, their difficulties or problems and da-da-da-da. Of course, we need to know all of that stuff. But it's really rather a question of what comes first. You could argue that this is a chicken-egg situation. One could. And I think in practice it often is. But the thing that really, I think, sort of turned this around for me was the problem of how do we understand moha, confusion, delusion, ignorance. And they're expressed almost exclusively in terms of knowing how things are. And that somehow rings false to me, but in terms of, say, some of the parables that the arrow, the snake, these all seem to be pointing in a really rather different direction. So it's a question really of what do we give primacy to in this practice? What is this practice fundamentally about? Let's say that I, you know, you know, in certain ways, I've got an incorrect understanding of things. That may cause me some problems and difficulties, but it's not really what the practice is about. The practice is not really about dispelling certain bits of ignorance, although that might be helpful. But it really has to do with how do I live in a way that is that is caring, that is wise, that is ethical in a deep sense of how do I respond to the situation I'm in from moment to moment, within myself, within others. That's really going to be the benchmark that decides or, in a sense, aligns me with a particular practice. So I'm shifting priorities, let's say. Yes. Well, actually, that wasn't really the question. I mean, the question had to do with giving primacy to knowledge or knowing things, or giving primacy to doing things. It's that was the distinction I'm making. The inner-outer distinction is a different one. I would probably... Well, actually, in many respects, this depends, I think, on where you happen to be in your life. I think Buddhism... or Buddhist practice often appeals to people when they feel that there's some inner work they need to do. And I think it's important, especially our society, which doesn't really, we're not educated at school on in inner work, as we might call it here. It's quite outwardly oriented. So clearly we need to realign that and get it into balance. And clearly what we're doing here on a day like this is essentially, in silence, in solitude, working on the cultivation of attention and awareness and so on, a very private inner activity. But obviously we do that in order that we can live better. And that living better is not something we can do in the privacy of our own minds. It has to do with how we relate to other people, how we relate to the world, how we get about in our lives, in society, and so on. And so the two clearly have to be in balance in that regard. And I wasn't, my talk was really not about that particular distinction. It's okay. No, it's a valid point. Yes. You were meant... Oh, they've been neglected, have they?
Where I don't know which way it's going to go, and to get compassion again from
I think that makes a lot of sense, and I'm very glad that you raised it, because I can't imagine you're the only person in the room who hasn't who hasn't undergone a similar roller coaster of emotion in the last 24 hours, myself included. And I woke up. I live in France. You see, I'm an immigrant. And I identify very, very passionately with Europe. I feel myself to be European more than British, to be honest. And this referendum will lead me to becoming French. I will apply for French citizenship as soon as I get home. So yeah, I think it's a major turning point in our society here. It's bewildering. I never expected it would happen. I was convinced they would vote to remain in. Absolutely convinced. Got it totally wrong. Liz. Thank you. Yeah, I think that's. I mean, it's a very. It's a very good, challenge. It's all very well to say, I practice mindfulness. I'm a Buddhist or whatever. Peace and love, calm, equanimity. All of these things we talk about. And then something like this happens, and it really just sort of. I think it's entirely natural that it can generate huge waves of emotion and fear and anger, or presumably, if you believe the other side, then enormous sense of relief and gladness and joy. Given that this is Cambridge, given that it predominantly is a Remain place, 73.8%. Okay, So, if I'd given this talk, say, in Hull, or... we laugh. Isn't that a telling indicator of where we come from? It could have been a very different situation. To me, what really deeply troubles me is I don't know whether this will make people better off or worse off or whatever. I have no way of knowing that. But what I do know is that this is a movement towards separation. It's a movement towards isolation. It's premised on self-interest. It's premised on fear. And all of these things are deeply contrary to what I value. Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's very important too. I mean, not I mean, how would, in terms of say, feeling compassion and concern for others, caring for others, it's so easy to somehow care for those we know, or care for those who are suffering or sick or ill, but there's almost invariably some part of the other who we kind of ignore, or we slightly disdain, or and I think, and I agree with you. I found myself thinking along these lines too, that people, you know, they may, it may be driven by selfishness and fear and isolation, but those are kind of abstract principles that I would, you know, I don't particularly endorse. But one has to recognize that for many people, people like us, you know, with, you know, reasonable, you know, caring people, feel that they are not being, you know, that they're somehow being marginalized, outcast. And that's just as important to bear in mind as our own sense of frustration. Yes? Uh-huh. Yeah, that seems to be a reasonable way. Yeah.
I have a very question to talk about. So, if the spirit was anyone else, do you talk about this issue?
Okay. Is there anything that we'd like to we could. Okay, we'll come back to you. Yes. Yeah, no, I can see that too. I mean, some of the thoughts that have run through my mind are not terribly edifying. Even questioning this sort of popular democracy. Okay, well, thank you. But I mean, in principle, the way that we deal with the pain in our knee is basically what we provide in the formal practice of meditation. Let's say to deal with physical pain or mental anxiety or something. The overarching framework and principles of practice and ethics are the same. And what we're doing in a meditation day is a kind of microcosm of how we would aspire to live in the social world. And yet it's on occasions like this that we sometimes see the disconnect between what I can achieve in my nice, comfortable meditation group or on retreat and how I find myself thinking and behaving when confronted with this, with these vast systemic historical issues of which I'm, you know, a tiny, tiny little part. And that, I think, again, really needs to, we need to bring this into our reflection as to what we're doing in this practice. Did you have a point? Yes. Okay, point taken. Yes? Middle way, yeah, that would have solved the problem. It's true, I agree with you. Yeah, translation, Boris Johnson set this up in order that he could be Prime Minister. No. Okay. All right, let's... Yes, here. Yes, you... Thank you. Yeah. So it's in Mark Williams' book on mindfulness, right? What's it called? Oh, Peace in a Frantic World by Mark Williams. The Green Book. Okay, yes. Oh, this lady here. Yes. Thank you. That's true. Yes, Christine. Is it Christine? Christina. Etty Hillerson. Oh no, someone else.
And she spent some time in the concentration camp with her sister. She was a Christian, in her quote. And anyway, she said the biggest sickness in the concentration camp was selfishness. Because when human beings are threatened in their basic needs, they don't think of others anymore. They only think about getting the little scrub of food you can get, the bit of clothes you just rip off, someone just dies, something like that. And he said, and in such an environment where the threat to yourself is great, is to keep compassionate and to keep on sharing is the only way. I thought this is something.
Thank you. Yeah. No, that's very beautiful. That's lovely. Yes. Well, actually, funnily enough, that's an idea that I've also explored as a way of seeing this. It's a partial.
Your elephant thing, the blind man and the elephant, is a nice image for me to understand.
Of that, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it's a partial vision of a much bigger picture, which really I don't think anyone can ever have. So this question about when you call this the kind of Socratic knowledge versus the Aristotelian knowledge.
Yeah, that's. I think that's helpful. Well, as I was saying this afternoon, to me, I'm thinking more and more in terms of delusion, not as a failure to know something, but as a failure to know what to do. Knowing, I don't know how to act. That's where I feel most ethically deluded. I don't know what to think, and this is what's been expressed. How do I think about this? What do I say about this? What do I do about this? That to me is a much more, in some senses, more pressing form of delusion than the fact that, okay, I'm only seeing a part of the picture. That's also true, and that needs to be taken into account. But at the end of the day, I think what matters for us most deeply as human beings is how do I think, how do I speak, how do I act? What do I do? To me, that's the more primary question, as opposed to, you know, what is the reality of the situation? What is the big picture? Again,
you can't know that.
You can't know that. There's a lot of sides to it, and obviously our knowledge will be partial. At some level, I would actually adhere to a kind of Pironian skepticism. In other words, are we actually capable as human beings to access what is in fact reality or the case? Maybe we just cannot, given the way we are, ever know that. We are limited by the very, in a sort of Kantian sense, we're limited by the very categories of our brain, of our consciousness, and so on. We're always going to be in the dark. But at the same time, as moral beings, we are always obliged to act. And so that, to me, has to take priority over, you know, the big picture, the partial picture. We do as good as we can, But that doesn't ever mean that we can thereby be excused from having to act. We're going to have to stop in a minute. We're running out of time. Are you on this question now? Yeah, okay. Okay. That's a very good point. But you see, I do think this is where meditation somehow opens up a space where we can see that more clearly. By just learning to sort of be still and to pay attention, we start with the breath, the body. Then, of course, mindfulness is a progression from the body to the feelings and then to mental states. And they don't talk about that an awful lot. But effectively, greed, hatred, delusion, confusion, these are mental states. How do we practice mindfulness in the realm of our opinions and thoughts, our longings, our certainties, our convictions, our delusions? That's, I think, precisely what we, in a sense, find ourselves trying to do in this particular Brexit situation, for example. It confronts us with all this stuff. And I think you're right. I think confusion does feel like certainty, but if we can open up periodically this kind of mindful attention, which I think is essentially skeptical. In other words, we're actually allowing ourselves to say, I don't know. I really don't know for sure what all this is about. And that not knowing is not an indifference or a kind of a resignation, but it's a not knowing in which we are allowed to suspend our opinions or see our opinions as opinions, see our certainties as convictions, just mental states, and in doing so they can somehow lose their power over us, and we find perhaps the opening for a greater clarity, a greater, I would hope, moral or ethical intelligence to be able to come forth and to then lead to actions. And I think we're going to stop there. Thank you. I very much hope we can, in our practice, in our lives, use this experience, however we feel about it, to become more fully human. Thank you.